Hey everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today with me is Brian Riedel. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and one of the most prominent voices out there that covering the debt and deficit from a fiscally conservative perspective. Brian, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Brad.
So your work on this is all over the place, and you're a long-term budget hawk. You've been doing this for decades now. But for people who, frankly, like a lot of Americans, have let this issue slide to the back of their mind, can you just take us through where the problem is at? Just how out of control and high are debt levels right now?
Well, the national debt was about $6 trillion in 2007 before the last recession, and it seemed like a lot. It was 40% of the economy, $6 trillion. Right now, it's $23 trillion. So the debt has nearly quadrupled since 2007. It is now bigger than our economy for the first time since World War II. And you ain't seen nothing yet, because we are on pace to add well over $100 trillion in debt over the next three decades. And that's under the rosy scenario that assumes all tax cuts expire, no new bailouts, no new spending, and low interest rates. Realistically, we could see debt, you know, getting up to two, three times the size of the economy. Now, this is all monopoly money for people. I mean, the numbers get so big, they mean nothing. And so one way of looking at it is, if interest rates remain low, then in 30 years, half your taxes will go to interest on the debt. If interest rates rise, about two thirds or three quarters of your taxes will go towards interest on the debt. And in reality, what this will likely mean is that if we don't get spending under control, I would expect very large tax hikes over the next couple of decades, because the deficits are unsustainable. We would probably have to nearly double tax revenues. And ultimately, I think that's where we're headed.
Wow. I certainly hope I don't have to have my taxes doubled in the DC area. They are already high enough. But I guess, honestly, a lot of people don't really think about this issue in terms of the economics of it. So what's the 101 of why deficits matter, what their adverse impacts are?
The first reason deficits matter is because the federal budget impact is, when deficits get big, it costs interest. And the interest becomes a big part of the federal budget. Even if interest rates remain low, the debt can be so big that anyone who has student loans can tell you, if you owe enough money, even low interest rates can cause a lot, can cost a lot of money. And every dollar we spend on interest is a dollar we're not using for education programs, anti-poverty, infrastructure, defense, tax cuts. So you're diverting a lot of money. Another reason is, ultimately, at any given moment, there's only so many savings in the world that is available to be borrowed for business loans, home loans, car loans. And that's the stuff that really makes the economy bigger. That's what makes us prosperous, is when we borrow savings and turn it into investment. But if the government is borrowing up the savings to spend on Social Security benefits, then there's less savings available for business investment, again, for home loans. And what ends up happening is the price of savings goes up, the interest rate, and ultimately, you have less business investment, you have fewer home loans, and you're killing the investment that the economy needs to grow. Now, we don't see much of that today because interest rates are somewhat low, because people are basically afraid to invest right now, and people are saving a lot of money because they're nervous. But once the economy starts growing again, and people want to take out loans, you again may start to see what's called crowd out, where the government crowds out all the savings and there's less investment and growth. According to the Congressional Budget Office, if we just continue on our current path, in three decades, incomes will be $6,300 per person lower just because of debt than they would be otherwise. So for a family of four, that's $25,000 in lower family income as a result of slower growth because of this debt.
So that's a really interesting stat, and one I hadn't actually heard before. But one thing that interests me, how has COVID affected this? Because we've blown out the budget with several trillion-dollar, $2 trillion bills, and it was already on a bad trajectory. But surely this has to have sped it up rapidly, right?
clearly some COVID spending is necessary because you have to end the pandemic and end the recession. It is cheaper to spend what it takes to end the pandemic and end the recession than to let the pandemic go and the recession go for years. That would cost even more. But what they're doing in Congress is miles beyond what's actually needed to end the pandemic and the recession. As a matter of fact, more than 95% of the spending in the stimulus bill that just passed is actually unrelated to the public health side of the pandemic. It's unrelated, a lot of it, to what we need in the recession. When this bill is signed into law, we will have spent $5.4 trillion in 12 months on the pandemic. That is bigger than the entire federal budget. In fact, by the time we're done with this pandemic, 1/5 of the entire national debt will be from 12 months of the pandemic. 1/5 of the whole national debt will just be pandemic spending in the past year. And that's before we've taken into account the fact that the stimulus has a lot of temporary policies that you can bet is just going to be renewed.
Temporary.
This is going to end up about $7.5 trillion just in pandemic-related spending. And, when you started out with a national debt of $20 trillion and you spend $7 trillion on the pandemic, that's huge. It's a huge increase.
So one thing that jumps to mind is I'm hearing a lot from center-left economists and wonks that COVID is not the time to worry at all about the deficit. And I think you and I agree on, like, vaccine spending. We shouldn't be skimping, right? But a lot of this is far beyond that. But they say, you know what? The recession, just blow out the money printer. Just have the government spend like crazy. And then more broadly, I think the kind of center-left economist class has really started to say deficits don't matter that much. Yeah. And on the far left, you have theories that deficits don't matter at all, and you can just spend infinite money. Mm-hmm. What do you make of all that talk, and why is it presumably wrong?
It's dangerous. The argument that we see is that, well, interest rates are low today. The 10-year bond is about 1.3%. So, hey, what's the problem? We'd be crazy not to borrow at 1.3%. The problem is, why do you think interest rates are going to be 1.3% forever? Interest rates can rise. And the money that we borrow is mostly short-term debt. The average maturity of the government debt is 60 months, which means if interest rates rise, the whole debt is going to roll over into the higher interest rate. It reminds me of somebody who buys a $4 million house on an adjustable rate mortgage because rates are low today. Well, that's great, but what happens if rates rise? And the danger is we are essentially gambling our future on the idea that interest rates can never rise above 3% ever again. I mean, the amount of debt that's already in the pipeline the amount of debt we're adding now, if interest rates ever go to 3, 4, 5% ever again, we're going to be absolutely buried. And when I talk to these economists, I debated Jason Furman on this, who was a top economist under President Obama. I've debated a lot of them. They make the point interest rates are going to stay low forever, no matter what. And I find that amazingly hubristic because historically, economic forecasters have had a lot of egg on their face. They have gotten interest rates wrong for 30, 40, 50 years. They get economic growth wrong all the time. They did not anticipate the bubble in the 90s. They didn't anticipate the stock market bubble bursting in 2001. They did not anticipate the stock market in 2009. I mean, there's so many ways in which they get it wrong that when you hear economists say, I am comfortable gambling our future on interest rates staying below 3% forever, because I can say no matter how much we borrow, no matter what happens, interest rates will never rise again for any reason in the future of America. I think they're nuts. I think we need a little humility as forecasters. Interest rates will fluctuate just like the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked back at the graph of the 20th century and you had interest rates 7, 8, 9, 13%, tons of different times over the last 120 years. So
as late as 2007, they were nearly 5%. The people who say 5% could never happen again, they were 5% 14 years ago. I mean, this is not impossible. And as a matter of fact, rising debt raises interest rates by itself. So you actually have the debt will be putting upward pressure itself on interest rates. It would be a miracle if interest rates don't rise to 4 or 5%, given the effect that debt has on interest rates. I'm amazed by the economic hubris.
Yeah, and I can't help but jump to the intergenerational aspect of all of this, because it seems to me that the politicians today, you know, most people in Congress or the White House are boomers or even older. They are counting on the fact that, well, if interest rates rise, it's not going to be my problem. It'll be 10, 20 years from now. And so to me, there's something fundamentally immoral about it'd be one thing if we were doing the classic Keynes approach, you know, borrowing some money and then running a surplus to pay it down a few years later. But that's not what they're doing. They're running up huge trillions in debt and just basically sticking the tab to future generations. So I look at the massive debt as a giant redistribution of wealth away from future generations so that people who are older now can vote for and enjoy public largesse that they don't have to pay for.
Young people today baffle me. We are about to face the biggest intergenerational transfer of wealth in world history. When I said earlier, we're facing $100 trillion in deficits over the next 30 years, the way to look at the budget over the next 30 years is that the Social Security and Medicare systems will run a $100 trillion cash shortfall, and the rest of the budget is essentially balanced over 30 years. So we are going to borrow $100 trillion for Social Security and Medicare benefits, or more likely, we are going to raise taxes through the roof. We're going to have to nearly double taxes for Social Security and Medicare benefits. And you have all of these seniors and near seniors who are going to the polls and voting to not touch their Social Security and Medicare because I want my benefits, even though it far exceeds what I paid in. And you would think younger people would be balancing that, saying, I don't want to pay $100 trillion to pay for these benefits that exceed what they pay in.
They're voting for more.
And they're voting for more. I mean, like, you're basically the sheep voting to be eaten by the wolf. I mean, there's a generational economic battle going on, and the seniors are just cleaning up right now because young people aren't paying attention, or they think that there's some easy solution. No, you're gonna be the ones who get your taxes doubled. You're gonna be the one paying a 20 or 25% national sales tax, a doubling of your payroll taxes. You're gonna be the one paying through the nose so that wealthy seniors can get back triple what they paid into the Medicare system. It's remarkable the degree to which young people are completely getting their lunch eaten and they're not doing anything about it, and in some cases are complicit.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because part of me says, oh, well, that's human nature, right? People don't deal with a problem until it's on their doorstep. Mm-hmm. And so I've said, you know, we're not actually going to see meaningful action on this until the first time the shoe drops, the interest rates increase, and people have to pony up more taxes. But young generations have shown an ability to have foresight when it comes to the issue of climate change, right? Yes. They care about climate change. It consistently shows as one of their top polling priorities and political issues because they know there will be long-term costs, that what current generations are doing today will affect the environment for us 30, 50 years from now and for our kids. So clearly they have this foresight, but there seems to be a total disconnect and inconsistency with how young generations think about climate change and how they think about the national debt.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the parallel between climate and the 30-year debt projections have a lot of parallels. You know, with climate, the models, with climate, they will tell you the models don't lie. Even if it's cold out today, the long-term trends and the 30, 50-year models are undeniable. It's the same thing with the debt and Social Security and Medicare. These aren't just theoretical projections of our long-term debt. It's mostly driven by demographics. It's Social Security and Medicare. It's payments to seniors that are already projected and the formulas are already written. This isn't just theoretical. This is as certain as the climate models. And, you know, people will say, well, interest rates are low today, so who cares? Well, the temperature might be low today, That doesn't mean that the models are any different or that the long-term trends are any different. It's the same thing. And people on climate will say that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we start making changes today, we can avoid the bad climate future, because if you wait until the temperature rises 3 degrees, it's too late. It's the same thing with the debt numbers. If you start now, you can make changes. If you wait until we have $100 trillion debt and interest rates are 7% and all the baby boomers have already retired, by the time you feel it, it's too late. The parallels show that we are capable of mitigation strategies to avoid long-term calamities. But I'm kind of amazed that everybody's focused on avoiding the climate disaster, which is a worthy goal, but nobody's focused on the national debt. It's funny, my kids watch Nickelodeon all day. My kids are 5 and 8. And every 12-year-old on every Nickelodeon show was an environmental activist, every darn one of them. I would love for one of them to care about other long-term issues that can also affect us. You know, for instance, the national debt that's going to double their taxes. I would love, maybe it's too much to ask for a 12-year-old to care about economics, but I would just love for there to be a look at other issues that have the same long-term negative potentials.
Yeah, it is an interesting comparison. But to play devil's advocate with you for a minute, a lot of young people who support Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would say, well, we're not going to have a debt problem in the long term if we just stop doing Republican tax cuts for the rich and we actually increase taxes on the rich and make them pay their fair share. So can't we have all the new spending if we just increase taxes on the wealthy and the big corporations who have all this money to spare?
If we seized every dollar of income from millionaires, it would raise about 4 to 5% of GDP. That's not even enough to balance the 10-year budget. Every penny that you seized from them couldn't even balance the 10-year budget, much less pay for new spending. I recently added up all the progressive tax increases that are out there. I assumed a 70% income tax over 10 million, like AOC proposed. Getting rid of the cap on Social Security taxes at $140,000. I took the Sanders 8% wealth tax, the Sanders 77% estate tax. I raised capital gains taxes. I got rid of all corporate tax cuts. I raised corporate taxes to 40%. I did a financial transactions tax, a Wall Street tax, a Buffett tax. I added up everything. I got $13 trillion over 10 years. That is about enough to balance the budget, maybe, for the first 10 years. Every single tax hike out there could maybe balance the budget for 10 years. Well, Biden's proposing $11 trillion in new spending over 10 years. Warren had proposed $40 trillion over 10 years. Bernie Sanders proposed $97 trillion over 10 years. If every tax they have proposed would maybe balance the budget for 10 years, and then it would unbalance afterwards because Social Security and Medicare grow too fast. And even that's not even accounting for the negative economic effects. If in the rosiest case scenario, you could balance the budget for just 10 years with every one of their taxes, there's nothing left for the $11 trillion per decade from Biden, $40 trillion from Warren, $97 from Bernie. The numbers don't add up. And that's why in Europe, they don't finance socialism with 80% taxes on the rich. Their taxes on the rich aren't much higher than ours. The way they finance socialism in Europe is with payroll taxes of 30% and national sales taxes, called value-added taxes, as high as 27%. That's where all the money is. There's just not enough millionaires in America to pay for socialism. You have to tax the middle class to death. And one of the frustrations I have is that the people who say just tax the rich, they never actually put out a comprehensive plan of here's all the spending we want and all the tax hikes on the rich that could pay for it, because the numbers don't add up. So all you can do is talking points, or sometimes what they'll do is they'll propose the same tax to pay for 10 different things on 10 different days. But if they ever had to actually put the pen to paper and model it all, the numbers don't add up.
But the thing is, Brian, I don't think in their minds they have to do that, because these people, Bernie Sanders and AOC and people of their, you know, Democratic Socialist ilk, they're advised by people like Stephanie Kelton, the founder of modern monetary theory, which, as I'm sure you know, posits that basically deficits don't matter. And as long as the government can print money, it can spend as much as it wants, just with maybe inflation as a small concern somewhere down the line as a bound. This is, whether we like it or not, essentially the economic philosophy that's undergirding the left wing of the Democratic Party and also increasingly just all of it, not completely, but it's definitely seeping into the mainstream. How do you grapple with people who just think deficits and spending don't matter? I mean, it seems that they think the government can create wealth out of thin air. So how do we even rebut that notion?
MMT is popular, not necessarily because it came up with some great economic insight that just made sense to a lot of people. MMT is popular because it gives big spenders an intellectual cover for their big spending. I mean, if there are people who are looking for any excuse to spend $10, $20, $30 trillion, and MMT is just a theory you can take off the shelf and go, see, I have an economic theory that says this all works. MMT is not taken seriously by pretty much any economist. I mean, 98% of all economists reject MMT. There has been virtually no research in peer-reviewed journals supporting MMT. Instead, you have a book by Stephanie Kelton, blog posts by MMT, a few MMT economists, nothing that has survived peer review. And the reason it doesn't survive peer review is because it is laughably absurd. MMT basically says that the government can pay for any amount of spending with the printing press, likely to a certain level with no inflation. If it was that easy, everybody would have done this before, but the globe is littered with historical examples of hyperinflation from runaway printing money. This is not new. Obviously, if the government keeps printing money, you are going to have inflation. Now, more sophisticated MMT people will say, but if you do have inflation, you take the money out of the economy by raising taxes and then essentially burning the dollars. Well, what you're doing then is, first off, you're right back where you started. You're saying there actually is a budget constraint and you are going to have to raise taxes, which is exactly where we started. It's not a free lunch. But what you're doing in that situation is you're putting Congress in charge of monetary policy. You're saying let's say we have hyperinflation and it's starting to hurt the economy and put the economy into a recession, you really think Congress is going to have the political courage to steeply raise taxes in a free-falling economy in order to break the back of inflation? The reason that we have central bank independence across the developed world is because central banks need to be isolated from politics, because constricting monetary policy is never popular. And so the idea that we're going to put Congress in charge of monetary policy and trust them to hike taxes and burn the dollars during times of inflation and recession is so absurd that it's a reason that MMT not only fails economics, it fails basic political science. And it's going to be really popular on Twitter with, 23-year-olds who just want to come up with an excuse for why we can afford Bernie Sanders.
Hey, not all 23-year-olds.
Not just those who want an excuse for how we can afford Bernie Sanders. But among anybody who's thought for 10 minutes about this or taken economics, it is laughably absurd.
Yeah, but I guess to pivot a little bit on this, because, look, it's no secret I agree with you on all of this, but I do feel that the GOP and the right more broadly has lost a lot of credibility on this issue, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of us are speaking out right now against this massive bloated stimulus bill, $2 trillion almost, that like you noted, most of it's not related to COVID directly. A lot of it's partisan priorities. There's blue state bailouts. There's politicians' pet projects. And a lot of Republicans and conservative voices are speaking out against it. A few of them, like you and I, were consistent about this during the Trump years, but most elected Republicans basically went along with Trump and stopped caring about it, and at least a lot of them, if not most. And so my fear is that the future generations or Gen Z and millennials don't really view Republicans as credible or serious on these issues. So they just default to the left because they say, oh, those guys are hypocrites. They're just fair weather fiscal hawks. And isn't there some validity to that, even if not under the underlying merits, on the appearance and the political hypocrisy of it?
Absolutely. Republicans are hypocrites on deficits. I would still argue they're not nearly as irresponsible as Democrats are on deficits. But the two things that happened with Republicans on deficits is, first off, Donald Trump got elected in 2016 running against Social Security and Medicare reform. And what we learned, there was a Pew poll 6 months after Trump got elected that said only 15% of Republicans support addressing Medicare's deficits, and only 10% of Republicans support addressing Social Security. So the Paul Ryan wing basically died. Donald Trump exposed that Republican voters really aren't particularly fiscally conservative. And so, you know, the Paul Ryan generals looked around in 2016 and realized there was no army behind them, that Republican voters are actually very supportive of big government. And Donald Trump exposed that. The second thing that happened was the 2017 tax cuts. Whatever you think of the merits of the policies, and I think there were a lot of great policies tucked into the tax cuts, the fact that they were not paid for absolutely killed Republican credibility on deficits. I said at the time when this law was enacted that they were setting the case for entitlement reform back 10 years. If anything, I was wrong. They set it back 30 years because Republicans have no credibility on deficits. And how do you get Democrats to come to the table to reform Social Security and Medicare right after you just cut taxes? They never will. And politically, how do you cut Medicare right after you just cut taxes for Exxon? It's impossible. And so Republicans stopped talking about deficits because I've talked to Republican lawmakers who said every time I talk about deficits, the first question I get is, okay, start by repealing your tax cuts. And they got so tired of hearing that they just stopped talking about it. And so Republicans completely lost all credibility on deficits and lost the need to even talk about it. Now, when I say the Democrats have been worse, I would say the Democrats are worse in part because Social Security and Medicare and those are the bigger, much bigger drivers of deficits than the tax cuts. And the Democrats have been, for the last 30 years, the ones driving the entitlement train that are driving the $100 trillion deficits. I would also say with the Democrats, the Republicans cut taxes $2 trillion, and they turned around and proposed increasing spending by $10, $20, $30, $97 trillion. And so that's so much degrees worse. You know, I've joked in the past that, fine, Republicans cut taxes $2 trillion. We'll give the Democrats a check for $2 trillion for whatever they want, and then we'll call it even and get back to deficit reduction. But Democrats acting like a $2 trillion tax cut makes it okay for them to do a $97 trillion Bernie Sanders expansion of government is ludicrous. You know, cutting taxes 3% does not make it okay to increase spending by 150%. And so I think Democrats have been a little opportunistic here. But it's absolutely the case that Republicans burned themselves with the tax cuts, and they're going to have to put the tax cuts on the table if they ever want a deficit reduction deal again. That's just the reality of it. That's the price they're going to have to pay.
So I think this is an important conversation. I think it's people like you and me who still have some credibility on the issue who have to try and convince young people they should care about this. So I encourage people to check out your work, follow you on Twitter. The link is in the description below. But now I think we can wrap up with the most anticipated and excited part of the show. And that is, Brian, your hot food take.
Oh, boy. I'm from Wisconsin and I'm boring. My hot food take is that I still drink 3 cans of Mountain Dew a day, despite being a grown up. I don't eat anything like sushi. Everyone eats sushi these days. I still eat burgers, pizza, Mountain Dew, Chipotle. I am completely uncultured food-wise, and much to the horror of my wife and many others. So my hot food take is that Mountain Dew is better than sushi.
Wow, okay, that's quite a take. I have one that will probably one-up it. I hate all seafood. I don't eat any seafood. Anything that comes out of the ocean, I'm a pass on.
Good. I will eat shrimp, and that's it. It's the only seafood I eat.
Yeah, that's not going to do it for me, but that will do it for today's episode. So thanks everybody for tuning in, and we'll talk to you all again next time.